The Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development will now be in order. Today's date is Tuesday, March 10th. So we do try and wait till we have a quorum, so sorry for keeping people waiting. And I know we're going to begin today by hearing from the folks from College Possible, and they actually have another hearing across the way in the House. And so they're here, I know. So we're going to start with them. So if those folks from College Possible could come join us, that would be great. We're in for a treat today. We get to hear from College Possible. We get to hear from the Bush Foundation. We get to talk about teacher prep. So,
good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Jook. I'm the Executive Director of College Possible. College Possible is a nonprofit organization that was started here in Minnesota. We work with low-income high school juniors and seniors and with low-income college students to ensure that students are earning admission to college and successfully persisting in graduating from college. The students that are part of College Possible, over 90% of them are first-generation college students, 92% are students of color, and their average household income is $25,000 per year. We work with students, almost 2,000 high school students at 23 different high schools in Minnesota, more than 4,000 college students that are enrolled at 300 universities nationwide, including 70 here in Minnesota. And this spring, we will have our 1,500th college graduate. We work with low-income students junior year of high school to help them increase their college entrance exam scores. We take them on campus visits. We provide them with opportunities to do service in their schools and in their communities. We work with our students as seniors to make sure that each is applying for at least 5 institutions, to make sure that each completes their FAFSA and secures private scholarships and financial aid so that they can successfully go on to higher education. We support our students through their transition from high school to college and then coach them all the way through college, helping them navigate the resources on campus, build a network of support on their campuses, and ultimately persist and graduate. The results of College Possible are unmatched. 98% of our students have earned admission to college, and a College Possible student is 10 times more likely than their low-income peers to earn a college degree. As of last year, we have Harvard randomized control trial evidence, so the gold standard of evaluation has found that a College Possible student is more likely to apply for and enroll in a 4-year institution. We are now the only college access program in the nation that has this level of evidence behind us. We've also had local economists evaluate our program and have found a 300% return on investment. We have more than 20 high schools on a waiting list to have the College Possible program within their high schools, and we have more and more students enrolled in campuses across the state. So we have students on 70 campuses across the state. And so what we are hoping to do in the future would be not only to grow our high school programming, both in the Twin Cities and throughout greater Minnesota, but to also expand our college programming so that we can have more campus-based coaches on college campuses supporting our students. We've found that when we're able to put one of our coaches on a college campus, we see an increased persistence and graduation rate over 20% of our low-income students. Joining me today is Yadira Salinas. Yadira was a student in our program and is now one of our coaches that is coaching her own group of students at a Minneapolis high school. So I'll turn it to Yadira.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Welcome, Yadira.
Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Like she mentioned, my name is Yadira Sevilla Salinas, and I grew up here in the west side of St. Paul. I'm the oldest of 3 children, and I was the first in my entire family to not only enroll but graduate from a four-year university. I attended Minnesota State University Mankato and graduated last May with a Bachelor of Science in Communication Studies and a Bachelor of Arts in Spanish. Luckily for me, I attended Central High School, and I came across what was then called Admission Possible, and with them, I was able to increase my ACT score to hit the sweet spot in order to have a wide range of college options for when I applied, and with their help, I was able to enroll into Mankato State, and once I was there, I also had support from a lot of college coaches to help me, not only get there, but graduate. And this year, I am serving as a junior coach at Patrick Henry High School in North Minneapolis. I work with 41 juniors, and I'm also helping them, guiding them, and motivating them with all of the resources that College Possible offers, but also with my own story. And a lot of it, too, is just like building confidence within themselves. I had one student in particular who wasn't completely confident. Like, they knew they wanted to go, but, you know, there's other things that can get in the way, and they weren't completely confident that college was an option for them. But with the ACT score alone, we've had 3 practice tests, and they increased 9 points from a 13 to a 22. And we have our 4th test this weekend, actually, so I'm really excited to see just where my students end up with that. And your junior year, college can seem really far away, but the more you prepare from younger on, it can make a big difference. And like I mentioned earlier, I was the first in my extended family to go to college, and that helped me start a trend in my own family. This year I have 2 cousins in their 2nd year of college and a sister in her 1st year of college, and a brother who's doing high school and college classes combined. So it was really nice for me to start that trend in my family and in my community with the help of College Possible. Thank you so much for your time.
And inspiring story. Thank you so much. Yeah, people applauded in the audience. That's wonderful. Members, I'll open up for questions. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, quite impressive results indeed. And I'm looking at your brochure, and I noticed that you are being served with the AmeriCorps volunteers, and as someone who sits on the Serve Minnesota board along with Senator Kent, and we're familiar with Reading Corps, but tell me a little bit about your interaction with AmeriCorps.
Ms. Duke. Madam Chair, Senator, we have been a longtime partner of the AmeriCorps of Serve Minnesota and the Corporation for National and Community Service. We were actually the first program in the country to utilize AmeriCorps members in this model, in this college access model. So we currently have 75 members that serve with us here in the Twin Cities as coaches. Some of those members are through Serve Minnesota, and others are through the National Corporation, through a National Direct Grant. And so all of those coaches spend a year of service with us. Many will return for a 2nd year of service to continue supporting those students through their college admission and success process. We've been really thrilled with the partnership that we've had with Serve Minnesota over the years. It's been a very collaborative partnership. We continue to work closely with the corporation and with Serve Minnesota to make sure that we are making sure that our coaches have the very best experience possible, that we are retaining all of our members, and that we are a really great place for members to serve with us. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. How are you training those coaches? So what type of training do either the AmeriCorps or other coaches receive?
Ms. Duke. Madam Chair, Senator, we when a Corps member or a coach starts their term of service with us, we have 3 weeks of intensive training where we make sure that they're prepared to deliver curriculum in a classroom, that they're prepared to work with the demographics of Minnesota and with the many different groups of students that we're working with. And then throughout their entire year, their entire term of service, coaches will spend 4 days a week on their site, so either in a high school or on a college campus, and they spend every Friday with us 8 to 10 hours of training each week to make sure that our students or that our coaches are well prepared to support their students with curriculum, with life, and to help navigate the process.
Thank you very much.
Members, you might remember that last biennium we contributed $750,000 towards College Possible's expansion in Minnesota. And so I guess what I would ask is how have you used those funds? And this biennium, Senator Cohn has reintroduced a bill where he has requested $2 million as ongoing funding, and if you could also share what you would do if we were able to provide that appropriation.
Certainly, Madam Chair. We use this, so thank you so much for the appropriation that we received. The funding allowed us to expand in 3 of our current high schools. So we were able to expand in Champlain Park High School, in Roosevelt High School in Minneapolis, and in UBA Medical Academy, a charter school in Hopkins. We were also able to add 3 brand new schools where we're delivering our high school programming, in Burnsville, in Roseville, and North Community School in North Minneapolis. In addition to that targeted high school growth, we were also able to put more coaches on college campuses. So with the additional funding, we were able to put a coach on the St. Paul College campus for this year, on the St. John's and St. Ben's campuses, on the Minnesota State Mankato campus, and on the St. Cloud State campus, where we have large concentrations of students, where we wanted to see increased persistence and graduation of our students on those campuses. In the future, we would use additional funding to continue that expansion. With more than 20 high schools on a waiting list for our programs, we are eager to be able to expand our programming in the Twin Cities as well as in Greater Minnesota. We've had a number of inquiries from district leadership throughout the state looking to have college possible in their schools, in their communities. So we would use the funding to expand in the Twin Cities, in Greater Minnesota with our high school programming, as well as to put more coaches on college campuses throughout the state. With 70 institutions that our students are attending in the state of Minnesota, and the proven model of a coach on that campus increasing graduation rates by 20%, we know that it's a wise investment if we can put those coaches on campuses throughout the state.
Well, that's a remarkable accomplishment. Thank you. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am curious about the structure right now and the ethnic and racial breakdown of your board and your staff. Could you tell me a little bit about who is in your board and who has been hired? Tell me the number of people and their ethnic and racial background, please.
Ms. Zook.
Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Ray. We have approximately 15 to 16 members of our board. On our board, we have two alumni of our program, as well as a former AmeriCorps member that once served with us as a coach that has a seat on our board. In addition, we look at diversity in a number of ways. We look at racial diversity as well as we look at socioeconomic diversity, in that we look for board members that were perhaps from first generation college students or were low income students themselves. More than one third of our board then meets either racial diversity or socioeconomic diversity for our team. We have 100 people on our team in the Twin Cities. 75 of those are AmeriCorps members, and just over 20 of those are our full-time leadership team members. And approximately 50% of our team represents the diversity that we're looking to achieve as an organization, either racial diversity, ethnic diversity, or low-income first-generation college student.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you. Madam Chair, so there are two people of color in your board of 15 people?
There are, Ms. Zook, sorry, Madam Chair, Senator, there are 5 people of color on our board.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm thinking about your waiting list. It's always a good problem to have. But what I'd like to know is how do you prioritize? How do you determine where your next venue is going to be? What criteria do you use for that?
Ms. Sue.
Madam Chair, Senator, as we look to expand our high school programming, the first criteria that we use is the number of low-income students that are in that high school. We want to make sure that we are able to serve as many students as possible with the resources that we have. And so a coach like Yadi here would work with approximately 40 students at a high school. So we would look for a high school population where there would at least be 40 eligible low-income students that would meet a GPA requirement of 2.0 or greater. So that first criteria is would we be able to serve enough students in that high school? Then we look at the relationship that we have with the school district, as well as relationships that we would have with counseling and administration to make sure that we can really be a partner at the school, to make sure that we would complement other programs that are at the school, that we could add programming if the school doesn't have any other college access type of programming for students, and we could really be a fit there. So we look for a place where we can serve as many students as possible and be a great fit within the school, within the district, and within the community. So historically, that's the approach we've taken with our Twin Cities high schools. We would do the same as we would look at schools throughout Greater Minnesota, is where could we find enough students that we could serve and be a great partner for the school and the community.
And one addition.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just a different question. The timeline is very interesting as well, to see that this started as a Minnesota idea and a Minnesota program and now is being adopted in other states as well, much as Reading Corps is a Minnesota program that is being adopted in other states as well. And I notice 2014, College Possible begins the virtual advising program. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Ms. Suk.
Sure.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson. We are one of four organizations in the country that has been selected by the Bloomberg Family Foundation to pilot a virtual advising corps. And that is using technology and having coaches work with low-income students that are higher-achieving students, working with those students nationally to make sure that they are aware of all of the college options in front of them and making sure that they're most appropriately matched with an institution. So really encouraging low-income students to explore more selective institutions. So we're one of four organizations in the country that is piloting this program. Our national organization is piloting the program, and we're taking the learnings to work in our site with our higher-achieving students and also to learn more about the use of technology with students so that we could expand even more broadly throughout the state using a form of technology.
Thank you. And Ms. Suk, I know that the TRIA program has lost significant funding with the cuts that happened at the federal level. Do you work on the campuses where you both are there? Do you find that you have synergy? Do you work side by side? Any comments on that?
Thanks for the question, Madam Chair. We find in both our high school program and in our college program that we are working side by side with TRIO programs regularly, and we've made a very conscious effort with our high school program to make sure that we're not overlapping with TRIO programs, that we are serving different students so that we can maximize the reach of both organizations in a high school. And we find that oftentimes we are referring students to the TRIO programs, TRIO programs are referring students to us, and we're working hand in hand. On college campuses, it looks very much the same. We oftentimes will share an office or desk space with those other programs, all of us that have the goal in mind of more and more students earning admission to college and being successful.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? Well, the more that we realize intrusive advising and support can play a big difference and be really a game changer with regard to graduation, the more we're going to be counting on groups like yours. And so thank you for coming here today, and I'm sure we'll be talking as the session goes on.
Thank you
for coming and sharing your story with us and for the work you're doing and for being the inspiration to your family.
All right, thank you so much for all of your time as well.
Thank you.
So now we're going to hear from the Bush Foundation. Ms. Kayla Yang-Best and Ms. Allison Barman. And so for members who have served on K-12 over the years, you know, and I'm sure remember that the Bush Foundation some years back took on a very, very significant role in making sure our teacher prep programs in Minnesota are the very best that they can possibly be. And so it had been several years, and I had not heard what was happening with regard to this particular project. And so we reached out and asked questions, and they came back and shared with me some of the results, and I thought it would be important for the committee to hear what's happened with regard to this very large and important project for Minnesota.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kayla Yang-Best, and I'm Education Director at the Bush Foundation. This is my colleague, Allison Barman, Vice President of Strategy and Learning. We are really grateful to be here. Thank you for inviting us. The Bush Foundation is a private, independent foundation. We provide funding across many different areas in the region that we serve. There's three states, Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. We are here to share our learnings of the teacher preparation program that we've been involved in the last 5 years, with five more years to go. And so I wanted to just tee that up in terms of the type of organization we are. We are not here on to speak on behalf of any specific legislation before you today or in the future. But if any of the information provided would help you, we can only be glad that we're of some help.
Thank you.
I believe we gave a handout. If you have it, do not have it, let us know. We can get one to you. So for today, in preparing what to share with you, we kind of broke it into three areas. The first area is really giving you a little bit of background and context. That'll be really brief. We want to spend a lot of time answering your questions, so that we'll keep it short. And then we want to highlight some accomplishments and challenges to date. We want to be as candid about that as possible with you. And then finally, Allison would share some of our reflections on how we can create greater impact from here on forward. So with that, I'd like to turn your attention to the next page, which is page 4. So the Bush Foundation, as I said earlier, we focus on a couple of different areas, and the one of the areas is education. We've been at it since the founding of the Bush Foundation. And our education goal is to increase the percentage of students from all backgrounds who attain post-secondary success. One way to help advance that goal is through our Teacher Effectiveness Initiative, which we established back in 2009. We are 5 years into it. We have 5 more years to go. And the idea there is to work with 14 higher education institutions in their teacher preparation programs to produce effective teachers for our region. And the reason we did that was we believe that teachers matter the most to student achievement as a school-based factor. And so on that page, you'll see the three state maps of our region and the 14 institutions that we serve. They range from large R1 institutions to small private and public colleges and universities. It's across the spectrum. Very, very diverse. Turning to page 5, we try to highlight here in a really brief way of the scope of the work involved in the Teacher Effectiveness Initiative. It really spans across major pillars of teacher prep in the continuum of teacher preparation. We hear this across the country that we took on a huge undertaking being so comprehensive. So it ranges from the very beginning of recruitment on how do you target your recruitment strategies, who do you bring into the program in the first place, to preparing them so they're ready when they get out into the classroom, to holding higher education institutions to be part of the responsibility of helping the graduates obtain employment in the teaching field, and then supporting them in the first couple years of teaching, as those are the hardest periods for new teachers. And then, of course, the fifth area in that picture is the measurement, which is building a culture of data and measurement for continuous improvement across all of the pillars or all of the areas of work that I just highlighted. We'll try to go brief, and then we'll take all your questions. Going into area number 2 of highlighting accomplishments and challenges, I'll start with the accomplishments first. And I've sort of organized this in a way that follows the areas, the key stages of teacher prep, if you will. The first area, as I said, is the recruitment area. Prior to this initiative, many of the teacher preparation programs had not intentionally recruited specific types of candidates into the program. It was very open, very, very open. And today, we're seeing a much more focused approach to building their capacity and ability to recruit in very strategic ways. From really looking at the quality of the candidates to the diversity of the candidates that comes into the program. And many of them are really focusing their marketing strategy to attract high-need, high-demand areas from K-12, like ELL, STEM, or special needs interested candidates. Moving into the second pillar of prepare, what we're seeing there in terms of our achievements to date is that the prepare pillar is an area where teacher preparation programs, this is their sweet spot. They know this work. They do it well. It's within their domain. And they spend a lot of their time and resources into this space. And we've seen the most significant changes in the last 5 years in this specific stage of teacher prep. It ranges from really changing the curriculum in the classroom to changing how they provide field experiences for their teacher candidates. The field experiences, we hear a lot about clinical experiences, and they've really changed those to much earlier, much more robust, or rigorous, and much earlier on. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But you know, one of the examples we saw was in one of our higher education, the teacher preparation partners is in South Dakota. The South Dakota University 3 years ago piloted a year-long residency for their teacher candidates, and they learned so much from it. Now the state, the entire state, is mandating that all of their public universities do year-long residencies for teacher candidates before they obtain licensure. So I'm going to move on to the employee area. In the employee area, this is the most challenging for our teacher preparation institutions because it requires them to broaden the way they have traditionally thought about their role. Under this area of work, we really expect the teacher preparation programs to take on the responsibility or co-own the responsibility of helping the teacher candidates obtain a teaching position after they graduate from the institution rather than handing them a diploma and say bye. We now are asking them to help them prepare before graduation and well into after graduation on getting a job in the teaching field. What we found successful in this area is K-12 partnerships, and the teacher preparation institutions are getting much better at bridging across systems and building cohesive and close and intimate relationships with K-12 districts in a way that opens up conversations about demands for what kind of talent, and those are really resulting in some hires, but certainly this area remains a real challenge area, and I'll say a little bit more about that later. What we're seeing that is really, you know, difficult to move this area forward is the tracking of performance of new teachers that would tie back. I'm sorry, I'm in the wrong area. Oh, yes. The K-12 districts are now looking at data that they now have. Some of them, not all of them, but they are looking at data that ties the teacher that they've hired to the teacher preparation program that teacher came from, and are beginning to make assessments and making hiring decisions on which institution to go to based on the type of teachers that they have and which institution they come from. So they're linking that teacher to the institution and holding that teacher accountable in making decisions on whether to go there to hire again or not. Moving to page 10, which is the support and induction phase of teacher prep, and this scope of work, is that we have asked our institutions to work with K-12 to provide support to new teachers in the classroom. This area is also one of the most challenging, and it really depends, the success really depends on the partnership with K-12. Now that the candidate is a teacher and is in the employment of the K-12 system, there's that collaboration needs to happen in order for them to define the role that they can in terms of supporting, providing support. Support ranges anywhere from what we see today, from establishing direct programs with K-12 to provide mentoring for the new teachers that are with master teachers, and the master teachers are getting professional development at the higher education institution. So we're seeing some of this happening between those two systems. And then finally, in the measure area, we're seeing that the teacher preparation programs are really progressing toward creating this culture of data and evidence-based culture for continuous improvement, if you will. The tool that they use currently is one that we developed out of the initiative that has been piloted for the last 4 years, and it's called the Common Metrics System, which is a system consistently across all the 14 institutions are using it. So today we have data of 3 years that cut across 14 of the institutions, and we can begin to look at each individual institution compared to the aggregate, how the teachers are performing based on these tools. Again, the purpose of these tools were for program improvement, and so it's remained at the higher education institutions at this period. So that's what we've been able to accomplish to date. We certainly realize that there have been major challenges along the way, and one of the greatest challenges noted on page 12 here is sustaining any of the changes that we've made so far. We made quite a bit of changes, as I explained, across those, you know, five pillars or stages of work. But in order for us to even make the changes that we've made today, there had to be major cultural shifts in higher education. And without those major shifts, we don't, in areas at the higher education, such as admissions policies or financing in how they think about the higher education, the College of Ed and the financing that comes through that vehicle into the higher education institution, without a shift in the way they think about this, we think that any of the changes we made so far may not be sustained over time.
Another area of challenge is assessing effectiveness. We've not figured that out to this date on the in terms of the initiative. The idea here is, you know, we can learn about program changes along the way, but ultimately we want to know what's the impact on the students of these teachers that's gone through this changed program, right? And there's not a way to do that right now. We know that the state has recently or last year rolled out teacher evaluations, and we're thankful for that. We're trying to build on that. But what the challenge remains is that the way to assess those areas in the teacher evaluation, such as student growth or student engagement or teacher practice, those areas were defined by the state. Those are great standards. But to assess each of those areas, it's really inconsistent. And if you have inconsistent methodologies to assess whether there's student growth or not, it's really difficult to look at the data and say, you know, what do we have? It's hard to compare and to look at the data across. So that's a continuing challenge for us that we're going to keep working on going into the next 5 years. And then I would say finally the last challenge here, a major one for us, is providing choices for K-12 to hire the best teachers. From what we've seen today, there is little competition for Minnesota's teacher preparation programs as talent providers. And we saw that several years ago, and so last year the Bush Foundation started some complementary funding or initiatives to this particular work by resourcing the TFA U of M partnership, which is the first Board of Teaching approved alternative teacher licensure program in the state of Minnesota. We're very proud to be part of that work. We are also testing 5 other local alternative models across Minnesota today. And as I said before, we think that alternative pathways is but one other method of looking at creating talent to drive better, creating competition to drive better talent development in our state. But there are many other ways, and that's the one that we're familiar with, which is the alternative pathways. So I'm going to stop there and see if Allison wants to add anything. If not, then we will move on to the third area of sharing what are our reflections for greater impact going forward.
And I'm sure there's many questions around the table.
Yes.
Senator Peterson, let's just take a moment for some questions, sure. And then we'll come back to you. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to the Bush Foundation for this work. When I just got to the legislature, you guys were just getting started, and the promise then was pretty great, and it was exciting. And I've since, correct me if I'm wrong, heard that you guys are running into some challenges and sort of figuring this stuff out. I don't want to preempt your final analysis, so if you don't want to speak to specifics, I guess that's fine. But the common metric system, I see that there's 4 areas that are in the survey. Could you just speak to some of the more specific items that are actually included in that? I can see they pertain to entry, exit, transition, so on and so forth, but just specifically, what sorts of things are you measuring in that?
So the first two...
Best Wing.
I'm sorry, Miss. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, the common metrics system has 4 instruments in it. The first 2, I would say, are in the pre-service before they are teaching. It's the entry into the program and exit out of the program, and measuring whether the teacher candidate felt first the exit, the entry. Why do you feel you were coming into this program, and getting a better gauge of what their interests are in coming into the program. As they exit, assessing whether they felt they're prepared. And whether they met their expectation as they went through the program. And then the transition to teaching and the supervisor, I would say, are in the in-service. They are postgraduate, so they are in the field for many of the respondents. And it measures what they felt they got out of their program. Is it really working in the classroom for them? It's a self-assessment. That's the transition to teaching. It's a self-assessment. It's self-reported. The supervisor then is the feedback of the supervisor on that teacher. Do you think your teacher was effective in the classroom on classroom management and those type around teacher practice? And it's coming from the supervisor. Does that answer your question, Senator?
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, thank you. It does. Madam Chair, I was actually curious if you guys were tracking entry GPA into the program, so to make determinations about maybe there's a prep program that's for some reason or another attracting higher tiered students. I was just wondering if that's also included in the...
Not formally. It's more anecdotal as we go out and hear things. There are some institutions that report that. I mean, the GPA has gone up for some of the institutions, but it's information that sort of there's intermittent in between, so we're not able to see if there's been this sort of trajectory.
Yeah, it would seem to me,
Senator Peterson,
Madam Chair, that would be one easy, maybe more objective data point to collect. I don't know to the extent to which you can make those changes, but that's been discussed for some time about the decile that the typical teacher graduates from, and be interesting to glean information with regard to that. That's all I have for now.
Senator Kent, did you have something?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question regarding on page 12, the sustaining the changes, and you said you talked about the cultural shifts in major areas such as admissions policies and the financing of higher education, particularly the College of Education. Could you talk more specifically, go into a little more detail about what those changes in admissions policies might look like and how the financing could be effectively changed?
Ms. Yang Best.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Those two are very linked together. Admissions policy today, and this is a generalization, it's open because the tuition that comes in from those who are accepted is what the College of Ed needs to survive, if I can put it candidly. And if you're going to be selective in the type of caliber of students that come into this program to become great teachers, that those two are in conflict with each other, can be in conflict, and we've seen some of that. So that's what that point is meant to say.
Thank you.
Senator Peterson, then Senator Claussen, then Senator Nelson. Sorry.
Madam Chair, just on the same point, the financing of higher ed in particular, if you could just speak to that in more detail, that'd be great. That's the
Ms.
sum
Yang
total
Best.
Of my comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I'm getting the hang of this. As I said, I think they're linked together. If the higher education is, the College of Ed is reliant on its survival on tuitions, and there's no other source of financing for their existence, I think you're going to be challenged on whether you can be selective or not. And so what you end up is having an open admission policy in some cases where if you show up at the door, you can pay tuition, we can collect that, you're in. And so unless there's other alternatives or other models on how College of Eds can survive financially, or in some cases, the College of Ed is the cash cow for the higher education institution itself. If there's other ways to supplement that, and I'm sorry to use that word here, but I want to be candid. This is the stuff we're hearing. This is the language we're hearing, and so I'm not making this up. is that there has to be a different way for that financing or some other means, because those two are in conflict. And our goal on this piece is for recruiting recruiting candidates will meet the demands of the market. And it's not happening at the rate that we're seeing today.
Ms. Barman, did you have something you wanted to add to that?
Yes, Madam Chairman. Thank you. I was just going to add that it's about the incentives, right, that they're incented in some ways to let more students in versus incented to be really selective. So I don't know if it's about supplementary financing, but it's about aligning incentives so that they are, incented to get the best candidates and only the best candidates in.
Senator Claussen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to talk a little bit about page 13, assessing effectiveness. What I'm seeing here is you're looking at how you can evaluate the teacher in the classroom and then relating back to the effectiveness of the teacher preparation program. As I look at that, there seems to be just a number of variables that you'd have to look at, from the demographics of the school to what the teacher is teaching to the preparation to the personal skills and motivation of the person. I'm just wondering, other than the teacher evaluation, if there are any instruments that you've identified to really assess this.
Ms. Barman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator, that's a great question. And we think the teacher evaluations are a great way to do it, and it looks at all the different things you look. The problem is getting those aggregated and tied back to the institutions. So we had gone down a path for a while looking at value-added measurement and tried to make that work as the metric, but again, it was the linkage piece that was the problem. We couldn't ever figure out a way to figure out all the students who went to one school versus one who went to the other school and tie them back. So our institutions right now are embarking on, we've just started, almost started over on that process, but they are all coming together now to embark on a five-year plan to develop that methodologies for themselves.
Okay. Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Because you're allowing the individual institutions to do this, it sounds like you could have several different evaluation programs, so to speak, in place.
Ms. Berman.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator. No, they're working together. We want a common methodology across the 14 institutions so that for this group of 14 institutions, they will have a common way to do that. But the challenge is that data does lie in other systems, right? It's in the K-12 system or other systems that they need to be able to access and aggregate. But, yeah, these 14 institutions will develop a common methodology.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you so much. I'm back on the discussion about this. I picked up on that comment, too, that Senator Kent did regarding we need a cultural change in higher ed. And specifically, you know, if you were queen for a day, what would that look like? Or either one of you, what would that cultural change look like that would allow higher education to end up producing highly effective teachers? So we've talked a little bit about the admission policies, and there are very selective schools that do have very selective policies. So I would like you to talk a little bit more about specifically what would you like to see the higher education culture to shift to or look like to actually be in a position where we are producing those highly effective teachers.
Yeah. Ms. Berman?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman and Senator, for the question. I mean, I would come back to page 5, where it shows the culture is really thinking about teacher preparation comprehensively, right? They have a very customer-centric mindset of what do our customers, the K-12 schools, need. So it's that customer-centric mindset and carrying that all the way through, thinking, what do we need, you know, thinking with that in the recruiting step, in the preparation step, and then on the back end. So, we've seen this happening in our schools, and I think we're really, really excited about the changes we've seen, the culture and the mindset that's getting them there. I think that what we're still concerned about is if it will be sustained. And that, to me, means it's really ingrained. It means we have some terrific champions at these schools right now. When they move on, is it going to stick, right? When that first really big challenge to the way they're working comes up, is it going to stick? And we're not sure if it's that ingrained yet and if the policies and culture is there to support that over the long term. But, I do think they're on the right track in a lot of ways, and it's just a matter of making sure that's sustained.
Members, go ahead.
Just a quick follow-up. Well, kind of back to this selective admissions, being more selective on admissions. I know that I think it was either this committee or education committee. We actually talked about prospective teachers before they actually enter the teaching program, making sure that they passed a basic skills test. So before they actually entered into the teaching program, making sure that they had that caliber of academia that was needed to help them be successful. Is that something along the lines that you would think would be helpful?
Ms. Yang-Best.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator. What we're hearing is that would be ideal. That would be ideal, and we would support that. That before a student spent 4 years in your program, mm-hmm. and all of the tuition and costs associated, and that they understand whether this is something that they really want to do and can do.
Okay. Thank you. And just one follow-up. Maybe your staff can give me a, what's the status of that? I remember these discussions. I just can't recall if we passed legislation, if it was a discussion item only. Can any of the staff kind of refresh my memory on that issue?
Well, Senator, it was in the K-12 committee, so it wasn't in this committee, okay. So I doubt that my staff would have that right at the top of their head. We did not require them to take it before. We said instead they had to take it before they entered the classroom, and it's been a subject of very much controversy ever since because, in fact, there's now a lot of discussion that particular test really isn't a basic skills test, but rather it's a much more complicated, rigorous test that that many can't pass. And so we could sit here for the next 2 hours and debate that issue. There was a task force that actually recommended scrapping it, and that never did happen. But ever since that discussion, and I know you don't sit on education any longer, but ever since then, every year we have fought over that issue.
And just one final comment.
Go ahead.
On that. So I think there is a real, and I think you and I worked on some exemptions of that particular test to make sure that teachers
with foreign
language
immersion.
Immersion. So I understand that. So maybe we just need to get a reliable test. But all right, thank you very much, Madam Chair.
And I guess, Ms. Yang Best, I had a question on page 11. Where you talk about the common metric system, but then when you talk about what that consists of, and in my understanding of the comments that you made to Senator Peterson, entry, exit, transition to teaching and supervisor, that seems disconnected to me from what I would predict that your data would measure, which would be more along the lines of a teacher evaluation tool, and then again, linking that data, the success of a teacher evaluation tool back to the program. And that was my understanding when you first embarked, so I wonder if you could just comment on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The four instruments, it's a system because it's all in how the data is used. So the use of the data asks for how the teacher is doing. So in essence, you are correct that it is measuring or evaluating the teacher. But they're looking at activities of what the teacher is performing. And so if the teacher's not performing specific tasks or activities that they, the higher education institution program, felt they were being, they had taught that specific skill, then they can change the program. And that's why it's a program enhancement tool rather than a teacher evaluation tool.
Mm. Okay. Yes, Ms. Berman.
Madam Chairman, can I add on to that? Because our dream is to do the teacher evaluation and tie it back. This was something that was easier to start with because this is survey. So the institutions, you know, survey their own students and their own graduates, and then that information is aggregated. So this was much more feasible to do in the very short term. But we still want to get to where and at the beginning of this initiative, that is what the hope was, to tie teacher effectiveness in the classroom back.
Thank you, Ms. Berman, because that is what I remember the conversation being. And so then when I heard these, it seemed it was more subjective and connected to what self-reporting in some ways rather than data that one could measure. So, thank you. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a very quick question. Like Senator Peterson, I have been tracking this from the very beginning. So could you remind me, how long have you been working on it, and what has been the investment so far?
Ms. Yang Best.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've been at it for 5 years. We're in the beginning of our sixth-year academic year. And the investments, if you look at it in terms of funding, has been significant. We are well over $30 million. And that's partly because to do this comprehensive work, the front end of it required a lot of funding. And so our funding was front-loaded into the first 4 years of the initiative, even though it's a 10-year initiative. Resources, aside from funding, are also come in the form of technical assistance through coaching on how you go through transformation at institutions. So we provide those to the institutions through our own funding, not through what we've given to the higher education institutions. All of that total is over $30 million at this point.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to leave that on the record because I knew that. Senator Kent and I had a conversation in Washington about 4 years ago, after you got elected. It is not 4 years ago. To take this as a number one priority and invited some of the freshmen to have this conversation and wanted to get the information from you. And it's just incredible to know that this amount of investment has gone into this and still we have a long way to go. So we have to do that without money. You know, we have to meet with 300-plus districts and try to figure out how to work with thousands of teachers and programs. And it's really an overwhelming task. And what we have been told is that really the only way to do this is to put a comprehensive approach that looks at training, support of teachers at the beginning of their careers, and evaluation. Mm-hmm. And the cost is about $250 million. If we really want to do comprehensive training, support and evaluation of teachers. And really, it's a significant task. I really appreciate all the work that you've done. And I very much hope that you're able to bring those messages to us because $30 million is really a considerable investment. And we appreciate that you did it, but I just feel incredibly disappointed that we're not able to build on what you've done really to move the policy forward, because I think at this point we do know what to do. And it's I think the task for us is to find the political will to do what needs to be done.
And Ms. Yang Best, it's great to have you join the Bush Foundation. Ms. Yang Best came from Cargill, and so I had worked with her previously on other initiatives. And so how long have you been with the Bush Foundation now?
Madam Chair, I've been there for almost 2 years now.
Oh, very good. Well, great addition, and thank you, Ms. Barman, for your work and for that you shared it with us today. And, of course, as policymakers, we're impatient. We want, the do this by then, and you'll all have, wonderful results. But I think we can see the movement, and we do look forward to the conclusions as they unfold. And I think with regard to effectiveness and recruitment, we all watch what's happening in Finland with interest, and so we understand what happens if you have a different way of recruiting top talent, and so we remain interested in that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now we're I know Senator Kiffmeyer has been here the longest and has been very patient, but we thought we would go to Senator Jensen first because her bills are on the agenda first because they relate to the teacher issue that we were just discussing. So, Senator Jensen, I believe you're next. Senate File 759.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here to present Senate File 759, which it's aimed at encouraging students to pursue a career in teaching and those already considering teaching to pursue teaching opportunities in high need fields and school districts. I do have an amendment that if someone could offer for me.
It's in your packet, two members. Senator Kent will... off of the A1, this is a delete all, and this is your first stop?
That's correct.
Yeah, so just to get the bill in the shape. Senator Jensen would like it. So all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the Education Committee, which I serve, we had a lot of conversation in regards to the areas that we are finding we have a shortage of teachers, and it was a report that came out. So my interest in this was to make sure we take a look at how are we going to deal with this problem. So what happens in this bill is we set out some definitions for who would this apply to, including and adding a school district, what that means, and you can read those. We established the program through the education, the commissioner, and that are you eligible? A teacher is eligible for the program if the teacher is teaching in a shortage area and complies with the requirements of the program. Section 4 talks about how would you apply for the program. And this is to cover teachers that may move back and forth between districts, so we wanted to make sure to include that, whether you're moving around. The forgiveness amount is an important aspect, and what we have in this bill is laid out as $3,000 are a cumulative balance of the recipient's qualified education loans, whichever amount is less. So that's what we're asking for in this bill. It's very specific that the teacher who adds a licensure field in a shortage area are eligible for the 5 years after receiving that license as well. There are some penalties laid out, and the Commissioner of Higher Education will report to the legislature each year of the progress of the program. And I'm asking for your support on this bill and would be happy to answer questions. Let's see, we have some people that want to testify. Oh, here we go.
Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Snezhana Besanov, and I'm here on behalf of Minnesota School Boards Association. Actually, I have a couple handouts if I may ask for a page. Thank you. MSBA represents all the locally elected school board members across the state. And first of all, we want to thank Senator Jensen for bringing this forward. This proposal will address, on some level, teacher shortage in Minnesota. We believe that Senate File 759 is one of the solutions to this growing issue. It encourages teacher candidates and teachers to acquire licenses and work in the designated teacher shortage area. Now, this proposal is similar to already established programs we have in Minnesota for health professionals, including dentists, public health workers, physicians, surgeons, and veterinarians who choose to work in shortage areas, as well as American Indian teachers. MSBA has a grassroots, member-driven approach to developing the platform. In December 2014, so just a few months ago, school board delegates overwhelmingly, passed two resolutions urging the legislature to provide school board members more flexibility in hiring and retaining highly qualified teachers. MSBA traveled across the state listening to the frustrations of school district leaders in regards to hiring and retaining highly qualified teachers. And four areas of concern stood out: teacher shortage, decrease in applicants across the state, losing good candidates to other states and districts, terminating or turning away highly qualified, excellent teachers due to licensure obstacles. And many of the same concerns were also noted in the Minnesota Department of Education 2015 Teacher Supply and Demand Report to the legislature, as it is done every 2 years as required by law. So according to the report, the number of new licenses granted in Minnesota has decreased by 822 since 2009 to 2013. So that's about 15%, according to my math. Decreases were apparent in nearly every licensure field. And please look at the Table 22 and one of the documents that's being handed out to see a dramatic percentage change of the licensure of teachers, new teachers leaving the program from 2010 to 2013-14 school year. So currently, outstate rural school districts are seeing a sharp decline in the number of applicants in response to certain teaching position openings. One district reported that they used to see hundreds of applicants for elementary vacancies, but most recently they generated only 11 applicants for five openings. In some areas of licensure, these school districts are still waiting to fill those positions. Minneapolis Public Schools reported for this school year they were on track to hire about 500 teachers. MSB noted that they're competing and recruiting statewide and nationally for special education teachers in all specialization areas, teachers of color, elementary and licensed teachers, bilingual teachers, and other hard-to-fill areas they identified were math, science, reading, world languages, and ESL. One of the Teacher Supply and Demand Report's findings is that while specific teacher licensure areas experience shortage remain the same, but the percentage of school districts indicating that it is difficult or impossible to hire highly qualified teachers in these areas is about double that is seen in 2012 survey. Teacher shortage in Minnesota has also gotten the attention of the U.S. Department of Education. federal government documents and designates teacher shortage areas for each state. And according to the letter that has also been passed out from U.S. Department of Education, the Office of Post-Secondary Education, dated on January 23, 2014, Minnesota has 27 licensure areas of shortage, and 9 of which are areas in special education. Just to give you a reference point, from 1990 to 1992, we had only 3 areas of shortage in total. But since 2005, the numbers started to grow, and they increasingly grow. So in conclusion, Minnesota is experiencing a teacher shortage in some licensure areas in many parts of the state. So we believe that this Senate File 759 is just one part of the solution, and it will take significant effort in this area to overcome this growing problem. So thank you so much for your consideration and support.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Ford. Everybody calls me Kitty, and I am the president of the Minnesota Association for Colleges of Teacher Education. We are here to speak on behalf of Senate File 759. We do agree that this will be one solution that could help us meet the shortage of teachers in Minnesota, a long-term solution. We know that shortages remain, even though the latest supply and demand report, which was previously referenced, indicates improvements in high school math and in high school science. New special education categories in Minnesota and their licenses have actually resulted in some significant licensure increases, but the shortages still remain. There are also shortages regionally, and these are the most hard hit, and that's where you see the biggest concern is in the regional shortages, especially in outstate of Minnesota. This is critical that we not only address these shortages with solutions such as this, but also address the ongoing causes of the shortages. One of the references in the previous speaker was to the fact that you saw a dramatic decrease in the number of licenses starting in 2009-2010. It just so happens that that number coincides with the adoption of the MTLE tests for basic skills. We saw a dramatic decrease in the number of people who could be licensed because of a test that you already mentioned in previous testimony has become an issue every single year. We are very hopeful that a new RFP that is soon to be released will allow us to have some release, and that too would be a long-term solution to providing licensed teachers in our classrooms. We support creating incentives that attract teachers into both shortage areas and into regions that have shortages. Loan forgiveness is a positive first step in creating those kinds of incentives. We believe that these incentives provide a more viable, sustainable solution to shortages than other short-term measures to lower teacher standards for licenses that may then negatively impact the student learning opportunities of our Minnesota students. We also note that this incentive program is very similar to a federal program called the Teach Grants, where students get loan forgiveness for $4,000, not $3,000, for working in the schools for up to 4 years, not 5 years. So we'd like to commend this bill, first in providing the finances for that loan forgiveness, but also for extending and encouraging and providing an incentive to encourage teachers to stay for 5 years for that loan forgiveness. This encourages roots in the communities that they will be serving so that they are more likely to actually remain in those communities because they've grown so attached to them. We won't have the same churn that we might have with teachers that are on emergency hires or that are from some other programs that maybe only last for 2 years and then go on to another state or another occupation altogether. We would like to speak on behalf of the Senate File 759 and encourage that you all consider it very highly for adoption. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Burr, I assume you're here to testify in support of the bill also. And in the interest of time, I guess if you could answer a question, because I'm sitting here wondering, is this the right place for this bill? that really it is, we're hearing it because the money is appropriated to the Office of Higher Ed for the loan forgiveness, but the other option would really be to appropriate the money to the Commissioner of Education, as the Commissioner of Education has the biggest purview and the biggest, broadest look over where the shortages do exist. In addition, I believe council believes that there should be some change to the language to make sure that with, regardless of where it goes, that it's set up properly. So if I could ask Mr. Fuller to make some comments.
Madam Chair, members, on page 2, line 13, you'll notice the teacher shortage loan forgiveness repayment fund is created. After created, I would add, is a special account, is a separate account in the special revenue fund in the state treasury. So we know where it goes. And then the same sort of language on page 2, line 26, when the money goes to the commissioner, it's really for deposit in the account because there's safeguards put in the account about that it doesn't lapse. So after education on line 26, insert for deposit in the teacher shortage loan forgiveness fund account for the purposes. So those are simply technical changes to protect the money and put it in the right spot.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller. Senator Jensen?
That's perfectly fine with me. I'm in agreement with the oral amendment.
Very good. So Senator Kent moves the language as stated by Mr. Fuller. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. And Ms. Bird, do you have a comment on my other point?
I just...
And say your name for the record.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Jody Boer with Education Minnesota. We simply wanted to come forward and offer our support for this bill. We have in the past actually offered proposals similar to this, loan forgiveness. In fact, Senator Torres Ray championed one of those proposals a few years ago. So we hear this a lot from our members, as you know, and we believe that it will help to attract and retain individuals. Also, depending on the amount of the loan forgiveness, I mean, we think not only will it help, it will help the burdens, but it could incent more teachers to go into the profession, which we think is also an area that we need to look at, and so we support that. Just one last comment. Thank you, Senator Jensen, for doing this. In addition to financial incentives and assistance for our teachers to attract and retain, one of the things that we hear often is around school climate, and people, our members, wanting to be respected for their profession. And I just think proposals that are positive, such as this, really help our members see that that positive reinforcement and respect for their profession is being duly noted. And we strongly, strongly support that. So thank you, members.
Thank you. So, members, any comments on MDE versus OHE? Senator Nelson?
Well, I think that's a – thank you, Madam Chair. I think that is a better fit for a lot of reasons, which you mentioned, but largely because MDE does oversee licensure. And this is all about the number of licensure and the number and the shortages. And MDE determines the shortages, whether they be by subject area or geography. So it seems like it would even be just a straighter route. Let's eliminate one elbow in the communications loop.
Right.
And so I do think it makes a lot of sense. And if you would like an amendment, I'd be
Senator
Jens.
Oh, Senator, look, Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I respectfully disagree with Senator Nelson. I think it is appropriate here. We've talked about loan refinance, loan forgiveness. Student loans and grants in general, and this is and what we're doing is really circling back to the higher ed workforce development piece of this, and forgiving something that was that originated in this committee. So I do think this is the appropriate point because we're talking about financial aid in some fashion when you're talking student loan, but I actually have a question around what would happen if requests for forgiveness exceeded the amount in the reserved account.
Well, Senator Pratt, do you understand? Ms. Weidman has a comment. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, basically the amount that could be forgiven would be limited to the appropriation amount. So they would have to have, yeah. And if you look at sub 5 on line 1.35, it says to the extent funding is available, the annual amount of teacher shortage forgiveness, et cetera. And this holds true for other loan forgiveness programs as well. I know there are a number of loan forgiveness programs for health professionals that are administered by the Department of Health, and the demand exceeds the amount appropriated for those programs.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I've got a $3,000 maximum, would I, and if, let's say, for example, we appropriated enough to where someone got $1,500, would they be able to apply for an additional $1,500 of forgiveness in the following year? Or is it just a matter of luck of the draw of what year they apply for forgiveness, and if it's a big year, they might get less, and if it's a relatively inactive year, they could get more.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, I believe the amount they would get would stay consistent from 1 year to the next, because you would get into the program and there would be an amount, whatever is within statute, that would be forgiven. And it would also depend, then they'd have to look at how many additional applicants there would be.
That's cool. And Senator Pratt, Subdivision 9 says that it goes through rulemaking, so I would also presume that there could be rules as to how this is determined, whether it be first come, first serve, or on what basis, what happened in the rulemaking process. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, that's correct. There could be criteria based on application, when the application is received, how much money there is. That would all be determined through that process.
Thank you. I appreciate you letting me get down to the weeds, Madam Chair.
Senator Jensen.
Madam Chair. To your question about why the drafting to the Office of Higher Education, it was drafted based on some of the other loan forgiveness program bills that are currently out there, plus the higher education does run the Minnesota State Grant Program, so that was part of the reasoning too.
Thank you, Senator Jensen. Well, and I would hate to change it, and to Senator Nelson's generous offer for an amendment, I would hate to change it without talking to Senator Wieger, because we wouldn't want your bill to get caught up in some kind of a conflict that way. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, Senator Jensen, I think that there is a tremendous value of really having higher ed be responsible for the entire process, because part of what we have now is that there is a disconnect. And this is really about trying to figure out how do we recruit, train, retain, support the teaching profession and address some of the issues like shortage, which you try to do in this particular bill. So I even think that it should be the Commissioner of Higher Ed that does all of this work and not K-12, to be honest. But, again, I don't want to derail your process, because you've gone really far now. So I just believe that it is important, and I don't know if you want to put the two. You have another stop. I also, in Subdivision 2, I think that there is a need on line 118 to say establish and publicize. And the reason is that I think people are sometimes, the way we promote these programs, if we approve this, is very critical. People need to know that this is available. And there is no language in your bill that asks the commissioners to really put something together that let people know. And then in your reporting, I presume that other summary data identified by the commissioner as outcome indicator will include this. You know, that language is broad enough that it could be anything, but I do think that you would benefit from having some language that actually says how many applicants, how many people submitted an application and were denied, although they met the criteria. Because the problem is always going to be money. You're going to have a lot of people that meet the criteria, yet they are not receiving the funding they need. So you might want to ask for that. So those are the only two things that I've got. Maybe missing.
And members, this is going to come back through the finance division, so if there are changes, it can be worked on before that. So, Senator Nelson, did you have to?
Just something real brief, ma'am. Okay. And this is truly just policy. And this has to do with how do we define a shortage area or a shortage field? And the reason I say that is because the information we have here, while it shows the number of new licenses granted each year, that really doesn't define a shortage because we don't see on here what student enrollment was. And so to really be helpful, I think we need to see what has student enrollment been. I believe we've been in a declining bit of student enrollment here and will be for the next few years, and then we'll be seeing a uptick. But I think that's an important piece of information that's missing. And then it drew me, missing that on the graph, drew me to the legislation, which just says the commissioner can annually designate. And there's really no criteria there about how she might designate what a shortage area is or how it's defined. So I would certainly like to see a better metric in determining a shortage area other than the commissioner just designating. And certainly looking at, I think, student enrollment numbers would be helpful in that. And then just one other comment had to do with really a correlation. I think one of the testifiers mentioned that the decrease in licensure might possibly it correlating with the MTLE test designed in 2009 and 2010. And it's hard to say. One could say that maybe these layoffs or maybe these declining teacher licensures might have to do with the fact that education is costing more. We know that it is. Students are taking on more and more debt, and maybe they feel that it's not as secure in an occupation where layoffs are determined solely by seniority. So I say we need to think carefully as we make those type of correlation arguments in committee here. There's a lot of different considerations there. But as a teacher myself, I know how important it is that we have teachers and quality teachers in our classroom. That really is what our quality education system rides on, is those teachers. So I'm very interested in this piece of legislation, but I think there's a few more details that need to be more finely determined.
Well, Senator Nelson, you work with Senator Johnson between yes. now and then, and there is in statute, members, a subdivision that does require the Commission of Education to survey the state school districts and teacher prep programs and report back with regard to shortages, as well as there are specific federal guidelines where the same information has to be gathered, and so it isn't quite as random as you might think.
Thank you.
And so where this bill, we believe it would have to go to state and local government because of the rulemaking. So we should send it on its way, and then we would get it back. So if some Senator Sharon will move Senator Jensen's bill, Senate file 759 as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to state and local government. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. So now, Senator Jensen, we're going to ask you to step away, and we're going to give Senator Kiffmeyer her chance because I'm getting concerned about the time, and I know Mr. Schoenfeld has also been very patient, but rather than get into another long loan forgiveness discussion, I want to make sure we give this conversation also its due. So thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer, for your patience.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I certainly understand the committee process, especially at this stage, being very busy as it is. And I got a lot of email and other work done while I was here. So
good.
Made good use of my time. So, Madam Chair, today I have two bills before you, Senate File 429 and Senate File 430. I will first take Senate File 429. It's a little bit shorter. What it does is to establish what is, I have heard, to be recognized standards for a concurrent enrollment course, in that you would use the same syllabus, the same exam, the same grading process. So for one part of this particular bill, that is the words that have been put in here, and my sense was if this is what they're already doing, maybe this is belt and suspenders, but nonetheless, it is still something that I think would be helpful to include. And
bless you.
All right. I have a testifier here, but he's testifying to both bills, and I think the second bill probably has a little more content to it. And so, Madam Chair, I also, on Senate File 430, I have a delete all amendment, which I did get to you ahead of time. And there might be more discussion on that particular one.
Well, so, Senator Kiffmeyer, I know some folks had expressed to me concern around, I thought it was even 429, in terms of the fact that faculty do have so much discretion. And so is it your sense that this, that 429 as written is not something that has, people aren't here to testify in opposition? Is that your sense?
Well, Madam Chair, in the meantime, I have worked with a lot of stakeholders, but we have focused more of our effort on 430.
Okay.
So that's why.
Great. So would you like to ask? Go ahead, Senator Klassen.
Thank you. Just one comment. If the institutions, the post-secondary institutions, would belong to the National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment, all these are requirements by that organization. So we should have that requirement, and Senator Kiffmeyer, you may recall in my other bill, I've got that as a requirement. But to simplify it might be use the National Alliance, membership versus specifically laying out the points. That's just a suggestion.
Madam Chair, Senator Klassen.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yes, things have changed since bill introduction, and your amendment takes away that the other language, that so that it is now required to have NACEP. And so, and yes, that is right. These are in line with NACEP standards. So it could be that this language could do that as well, that we could just simply add that same line to it as similar to Senator Klassen.
So, Senator Kiffmeyer, do you need us to move this bill so it goes back through finance, and because will K-12 pick this up, or is it your intention that we would have this in our higher ed policy bill?
Well, Madam Chair, I think if we could maybe switch over in here 430, it might become more clear for the members of the committee rather than further discussing 429.
So you'd like to have it laid on the table?
Just temporarily, if we could.
So, Senator Madam Nelson? Chair, I'd like to move we temporarily lay 429 on the table.
Very
and
good.
And can I move that we also bring up 430?
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so Senate File 430, I have a delete-all amendment. Having met with many stakeholders and taken a lot of input from them, so this is switching it from a study to a working group, because we're then able to get a much broader group of stakeholders to consider a variety of issues, but by using a working group to work together to pool all of their resources and their knowledge and their information, mm-hmm. we're going to be able to have a better handle. One of the things I found, Madam Chair, is that in this area of concurrent enrollment, this has become explosive in that its use and the varieties of them. You have dual enrollment, concurrent enrollment, college in the school, senior to sophomore. There are a whole variety of these. And popularity brings with it some issues. And one of my key considerations here is that the sense of both parents, taxpayers, students, and all is that the quality of the course that is taught in the college would be that same course that is taught in the high school. That is the premise by which we have seen. So what we started out with, post-secondary education, PSEO, was college in the college while you were in high school. However, what we've gone to now, for a variety of reasons, that we now have college in the high school with a dual credit. And so when the students went to an actual post-secondary institution, you had that because obviously it was at a college with those professors, with that syllabus, with that grading and that exam with all the other students. When we've gone to this where you now have it happening that it's being taught in the high school, the instructor of record is the college, and they're responsible to oversee, mentor, supervise, variety of words are used, to make sure that this course in the high school is indeed that same course with the same rigor, the same standards, and that if they graduate, or I'd rather complete that course successfully, that with the other students that are in an actual post-secondary institution, that would match up. That is the premise. And so because of the current law, which allows them to not use NACEP accreditation, that gives an opportunity for the questioning sometimes of, is there consistency? Are there those rigorous standards? Are what we expect and what we hope actually being in fact there? And especially when you have such a explosive use, it's not unusual for things to then become a little outlining outliers. So what we want to do in the work group, and I have a testifier here who can give you more content as to some of these concerns, is to be able to make sure that parents, students, high schools, post-secondary are in alignment with that kind of understanding. I had looked at it as a study, setting standards, but with all the input from stakeholders, that a work group would enable us to maybe come together, which is a really important component of concurrent enrollment this time, is to get together and to take a look at this. So with that, that's my introduction, Madam Chair, as to why the amendment, and it's a straightforward amendment in regards to the membership of the work group, and I've taken input from a variety of stakeholders, and also what the work group would review on page 2. But with that, I do have a testifier that may also help to set the conversation.
Very good. Thank you very much. Go ahead.
My name is John Palmer, and I live at 832 Halliday Road in St. Cloud, Minnesota. I'm in my last semester half-time at St. Cloud State. This is my 39th year of employment that is coming to an end. Wow. And I will be retired at the end of this school year.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you. I come primarily as an interested person with 7 grandchildren, one of which will be approaching high school age graduation. Like his mother, he is very talented. His mother, when she came back from Austria as an exchange student, had a stack of brochures that high waiting for her because of her score on the exam that was taken. So she had to sort through to decide which school she went through or would go to. That was our first encounter with pre-high college instruction. The institution I worked with would not accept her AP scores. The institution she chose to go to accepted all of her AP scores. When she transferred back to St. Cloud State to major in accounting, St. Cloud State accepted all of the credits that DePauw in Greencastle, Indiana had accepted. So I had a rather interesting pathway to looking at programming for high school students for college credit with my oldest child. I'm now looking at that for my oldest grandchild. And we have concerns about how concurrent enrollment is treated, not just in Minnesota, but across the country. We brought these concerns to Senator Kiffmeyer, who I've known since I was 5 years old, right? She's very young. And talked about the problems, The onset was the bill of Senate File 430, which called for a study. Immediately after my testimony, there were a substantial number of people that wanted to talk. And we talked. And there's been a great deal of activity since that hearing with regard to what I consider to be an explosive and unintended growth in a program that at my institution now represents 8% of all of our students in FYE. At some Minsku institutions, close to 40% of the FYE enrollment are high school students. At some institutions, we have sites of delivery that are 300 miles away from the post-secondary institution. I simply offer those as indicators that there's something awry with the delivery mechanism that currently is in place across the state. The way in which we can approach this is to rush forward and have a solution, or to take some time to take a look at the what the nature really is, i.e. then that turns into enrollment working group, concurrent enrollment working group. I in no way want to diminish the work that's been done by other authors on other bills related to this, but I do think it's important that the Senate and the legislative body, the House, realize how much this program has grown and the wide diversity of practice that as a grandparent, having had some experience with this, concerns me with the quality of what that grandchild of mine will receive in the way of instruction. My advice to my daughter and my grandson is take AP, because AP has a much longer track record of being accepted across the country. And the conservative approach is to do that which is currently widely accepted.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. Is there somebody else who wanted to speak, Senator Kiffmeyer?
Madam Chair, on the list here is another testifier, Julie Williams. And so glad to have Ms. Williams. Just stay here, John, in case there's questions.
And Senator Kiffmeyer, we have not moved the amendment, so let's do that first before we proceed. Senator Pratt moves the A-15 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you. Yes, Ms. Williams.
Julie Williams. I'm the Director of College and the Schools at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. So our program is the largest program in the state, and we account for, I think, about a quarter of the registrations in concurrent enrollment. And it's true, there is explosive growth in concurrent enrollment. But what I would suggest is that that the NACEP accreditation really has a lot of credibility in terms of the quality of the programs that are NACEP accredited. But in Minnesota, about half, well, actually it's a little more than half, of the concurrent enrollment programs are not NACEP accredited. And so I want to thank Senator Claussen for putting that into his bill. I think that will go a long way towards maintaining the kind of consistency that our parents and students and schools and legislators would like out of this. The second point that I wanted to make is that while I'm really happy that this has turned from a study into a work group, because it's going to involve a lot more people in making decisions about it, I'm still concerned about the level of specificity in what this work group is supposed to be looking at. And one of the reasons that I'm concerned about it is because the program, concurrent enrollment programs, are going to be tasked with paying for this. And we have not raised our fees in 7 years, and we are operating on a skeleton crew, and we have done this because we want to make sure that the high schools that want to work with us can afford to work with us. We just simply do not have the money to invest in a study that would include all of these things. So I'm just going to point out one that I think is particularly problematic for the College and the Schools program at the U of M Twin Cities.
Excuse me, Ms. Williams.
Yeah?
I just want you to know I don't read the cost in the way that you do, because it says that it's borne by the Department of Education and the post-secondary institutions' operating budget. So that would not be... So you've jumped to the conclusion they would assess it back on your program, but...
Well, I'm quite sure they would. I am quite sure that's what would happen. Yeah.
Well, we would have a conversation with them about that.
Okay. Okay. Well, if that's the case, then there may be no problem with this. But if it isn't, if I could just take two more minutes to explain what will happen if we are assessed that. So we work with 8,000 students a year. And we already do conduct student surveys because we're required by our NASEP accreditation to do that. But we don't sample. We don't look at every single student. We don't survey every single student. We do a random sample. But that's not going to be helpful if what we need to report back on are all of the post-secondary institutions that have accepted or rejected credit. The other thing that I think needs to be thought about here is that there are a number of legitimate reasons why a post-secondary institution would not accept credit, from the University of Minnesota Twin Cities concurrent enrollment program, and the transcripts that students take with them do not identify in any way that course was a concurrent enrollment course. But there still are legitimate reasons why post-secondary institutions wouldn't accept that credit. So to survey students, 8,000 students, about 13,000 registrations, and we would have to identify for them the courses they took through our post-secondary institution, because they are taking courses from multiple concurrent enrollment programs and from AP, and students get those confused all the time. So for us to do that, it would end up costing us about $16,000. To be able to do a survey that would have any validity whatsoever, we would have to survey those students and contact them at least three times. And we don't have $16,000. So that's...
Senator Kiffmeyer. Thank you, Ms. Williams.
Yeah.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. I'm not quite sure. I think Senator Claussen's bill had a survey. You're almost describing... I don't know if... There's not a survey...
But what you're requiring is that all post-secondary institutions that we report... I'm sorry.
Ms. Williams.
I'm sorry. What you're requiring in number four is that all post-secondary institutions, both in-state and out-of-state, that have accepted or denied transferring courses for college credit. And I don't know how else we would know that unless we surveyed the students.
Well,
Madam Chair, it would be my intention that this would be more of a to the university, not to the student, that we would send this work group, and that's the advantage of having a working group. You can work those things out. I mean, that's that advantage. You have the actual post-secondary institutions involved here, and so I would perceive this as sending a request to the actual post-secondary institution, not surveying a student. That's why it made me think it was part of Senator Claussen's bill language. Maybe that had affected this. And maybe that would make a difference if we don't survey students and instead request that from the university or the college themselves.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer.
That my one?
So was there anybody else who wanted to testify either in support or opposition to this bill? Go ahead. Ms. Schwab.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. And let me tell you, we are very good with talking about concurrent enrollment. I've talked to Senator Claussen about it a lot, and I think it's a very advantageous piece for high schools to have. And it's also a college feeder program, so it's really good for both of them. As we look at this bill, we just sort of did some quick math, and I think it is extremely important there be a balanced number of high school representatives and post-secondary representatives. So we really want to encourage you to make sure those numbers even out, or you're going to see one side or the other side jockeying for position. If you really want true and good data and have it reviewed, I think it is extremely important to have even numbers on both the higher ed and the K-12 side. So that's
Madam Chair, Senator Kiefmeyer.
We made our best effort to do that, and I was certainly open today by hearing and knowing that you're on the higher ed committee to hearing input, and I'm certainly glad to work with this in regards to Minnesota School Board Association to adapt that language.
Thank you. And the next stop for this bill would be the state government or state and local government, where the makeup of the membership would be the subject of discussion, so that could certainly be addressed at that time.
Okay.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Palmer or Ms. Williams, we were talking about how would the feedback come back if credits have been accepted or denied. When a transcript is requested and sent, is there any feedback to the university of whether or not those credits have been accepted or denied?
Chairman?
Yes.
Thank you.
Please, Mr.
Having served in the office of the provost at the university, I receive many parental inquiries on matters like this, that the primary contact point is when something goes wrong and a complaint is alleged. I often receive those kinds of complaints. Students order transcripts and have the transcripts delivered, and then it's discovered. I think that my colleague from the university, which is where my degree is from, my PhD, the word all does not mean you have to sample all. There are methodologies that are valid and appropriate to find out the nature and extent of a problem. And my testimony is that this is an area that needs to be looked at. The study group is a mechanism by which it would be looked at. The specific methodology by which those questions would be answered would be determined by the study group. You don't have to sample the universe to find out what is going on in a large-scale basis. You can, in fact, come up with a stratified random sample that you work hard to get the information on. I'm confident that can be done, and it can be done in a reasonable and cost-effective way, so that we know beforehand, truth in advertising, that a student who believes that they've got college credit doesn't later find out that, well, it's got an asterisk by it because they didn't read the fine print that the school district was conducting their concurrent program under a separate contract, which meant that different rules applied. So I hope I've answered your question, Senator Pratt, without being evasive, but without being overly professorial in my answer.
Mr. Bastian.
Madam Chair, Senators. My name is Kay Sebastian, and I am the director of the Senior to Sophomore program at St. Cloud State University. This program has been in existence for 19 years. I have been the chair or the director for 17 of those years. During that time, we have seen significant growth in the program, but we've also accompanied that with numerous efforts to make sure that our program is rigorous and matches what happens on our campus. We do a thorough application process, a significant orientation process. We have training. We have ongoing interactions with our faculty. We do evaluations. We are NASEP accredited, and many of the items that are talked about in the work group list are things that NASEP does evaluate. There are some of them that aren't, and those would, some of them seem to me perhaps don't necessarily go to quality, but other types of concerns that people might have. We have gotten very positive feedback from our students when we have done surveys of students, as NASEP requires us to do, and we get very little feedback about credits that do not transfer. There are some highly selective institutions around the country who have decided not to select or to accept any concurrent or any courses, college courses that are earned before a student has graduated from high school. And if you're a very highly selective university, you can do that. We, in the Minsky system, all concurrent enrollment credits earned at any other Minsky system school are accepted automatically. We've never had a difficulty with U of M in the Twin Cities. So in general, the courses are accepted quite well.
Thank you. And I would commend Senator Kiffmeyer, because we have heard that there are discrepancies between courses, between rigor. Now, with the addition of Senator Claussen's requirement that they all belong to NASEP, I think that's really movement. But I think in this whole PSEO area, we've got some real challenges with regard to our funding structure as well. And so I think by forming this working group on this subject, we lay some important foundation for how we're going to then proceed to look at funding in general for PSEO, which is an even broader really concern for all of us. Senator Claussen?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a few comments. Concurrent enrollment has been under attack here, but last week we had a presentation of our bill, I think, in E-12. It wasn't here.
Yep. It
was. Was here? I can't remember.
Oh, E-12.
Yeah, E-12. We had 17 testifiers. One of the documents from the University of Minnesota was their one-year and five-year study. They also gave a five-page handout identifying all of the institutions where their credit had been established and accepted around the country. The problem that we're having right now, as you dig into this issue, we have 27 institutions in the state of Minnesota that offer concurrent enrollment. Only 12 are certified nationally, and that is the problem. And I'm going to throw it back to those institutions and also to Minsky and ask, how did you ever allow this to happen? Because you should have had those campuses certified before they ever got into this. And we have some issues now that we want to catch up on that is kind of giving concurrent enrollment a black eye. But if you would have listened to those testifiers, and if you would have seen the number of credits that are being granted to students, if you see the colleges, universities are going to, the satisfaction surveys, where they're being accepted, I mean, there's no question that this is a great program. And I would just hate to see some negative pieces brought into it. And perhaps Senator Kiffmeyer's study is not a bad idea to look at it. But I'm going to go back to Minsky. And Minsky should really be taken to task on this for never really keeping track of what is happening with the concurrent enrollment programs, because those 12 institutions are all Minsky institutions that are granting credit but are not associated with the National Council for Accreditation. So that's my only comment.
And Senator Claussen, I want to thank you for the tremendous amount of work you've put into this area, and I know before serving your work on the Board of College and the Schools and your work at the university, and that you actually have made a big contribution to this area of study. So thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Yeah. And we know that the university, we're going to have to move on now, but we do know that the university has done a tremendous job in making sure that it is of the highest quality, and we expect that the output of this study, a working group, if we can find the funds for it and work that out, I think will lead us on a good path. So, Senator Nelson.
So, do we need to renew the motion then for Senate file?
We have not made the motion for this bill. It's been amended. We adopted the amendment.
Okay, so is it time? Could I move Senate file 430 as amended? Be
referred to state and local government.
Referred to state and local gov.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank
members.
You. Now, Senator Jensen, if you would like to very quickly do your bill.
She's planning to do 429.
Oh, 430. That was
That was 430. 429.
Right. 429, we laid it over. It's fine. We just laid it over.
What do you say?
Just laid on the table.
Oh, recommended. It's temporary. We referred.
Pardon? Members, before you, let's to clarify that last motion. Senator Sharon renews the Nelson motion that Senator Kiffmeyer's Senate File 430, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to state and local. I apologize for sloppy motions. So, all those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Now, Senator Johnson's bill is before us, and I'm going to hand the gavel to Senator Miller for a change.
Thank you, Madam Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Senate File 1084 is very similar to the bill, Senate File 759. This one is focused on ag educators. I have a handout that I put in the packet. It's actually from 2013, but it really lays out really well the problem that we're having and the decline we're seeing in ag educators in Minnesota. Back in 2013, there was a 29% decline in the number of licenses held by agricultural teachers, the second biggest drop by subject area next to family and consumer sciences. So just real briefly, the pool of agricultural teachers are so small in some areas that if the teacher resigns, they're not able to get a teacher and the program has to close. What are the barriers? And to your point on my last bill, Senator Nelson, this we are trying to dig in and try to figure out what is the underlying causes of some of this. Some of the key barriers to producing more agricultural teachers is that they get recruited by agricultural businesses and are able to make quite a bit more money doing that than they are actually being in the classroom. So with that, it's set up the same. The Office of Higher Education would actually do the functionality rather than Department of Education. It's a loan forgiveness program set up with the $3,000, the same as the other bill. So I have someone here that could talk to it a little bit, or I'd be happy to answer any questions. And it seems like the committee is shrinking.
Members, any questions? Otherwise, we have Mr. Schoenfeld here. And Senator Jensen, it looks like you have an A1 amendment.
Oh, gosh,
well.
I do. I have an A1 amendment if someone would like to move that for me.
Senator Claussen moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, committee members. This just moves the effective date for when they can actually qualify and apply for loan forgiveness.
Mr. Schoenfeld?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, committee members. It was mentioned by Senator Jensen that there has been declining numbers of instructors, but I don't want you to misunderstand the situation. Presently, in 2014-15, there was additional six programs were added in the state. And there's a total of 191 programs and 234 ag teachers. And in 2014, an additional 9.9 FTEs were added. So even though we're having difficulties with the number of instructors, we have been bringing in people from different areas outside of Minnesota. And one of the real problems that we have in Minnesota is the fact that there is only one school in the state of Minnesota that offers a degree in ag education, and that school is the University of Minnesota. And with regard to the University of Minnesota, because of their entrance requirements, the way they manage their total number of students, they only take in about 13 students a year in their freshman class. And that's one of the big problems we have. But this has been a problem for many years. And so one of the things that has occurred over the years is that we've oftentimes got our instructors from neighboring states, University of Wisconsin, River Falls, South Dakota State, NDSU. Recently, one of the things that's happened, of course, with North Dakota and their oil boom is that they have made it a much better place for teachers to be in North Dakota, in particular ag educators, and so we are able to receive less number of students out of North Dakota. South Dakota has put in a loan forgiveness program similar to what we're asking for here, and they're maintaining more teachers there. And so our pool from the outside of the state is becoming less and less. In addition to that, as agriculture over the last few years really flourished because of higher prices, agribusinesses expanded much quicker than some of the other parts of the country in terms of when the recession was going on. So because of that, there's also a greater demand for these teachers from outside. And comparison in terms of the amount of funds that are offered to these students coming out with an ag ed degree, in many cases they're in the mid-50s compared to probably the mid-30s for a educator. And so that's one of the problems that we've got, and that's one of the things that we hope the loan forgiveness program can help alleviate a little bit in terms of balancing that field out a bit. I would mention to you also that there's a couple of other things going on. One is that the number of urban schools that are offering ag education is increasing. For instance, ag education typically had been a more of a rural function, but today we have the Academy for Science and Agriculture in Van Nuys Heights. We have a Anoka Hennepin School District that has got 7 teachers in ag there, the Northeast Metro White Bear Lake area, Southwest Metro School of Environmental Studies in Apple Valley, the St. Paul Gordon Parks Alternative Learning Center, St. Paul Humboldt, and St. Paul Highland Park, that have both got 2 teachers apiece in agriculture. And others in the area around the suburbs, Forest Lake has got 3 teachers, Fridley, Hastings, Rockford, Stillwater have got 2 teachers. And so because of that, there's an increased demand that is happening not only in rural Minnesota, but also in the metropolitan area as well. In addition to that, I might point out that in rural areas in particular, where there are small schools, ag teachers are kind of a valuable commodity, because of the fact that their backgrounds and their education is so placed that they can provide a graduate, they can provide science within the agri-science fields that they teach, they can provide the science necessary for a graduation credit in the high school and also economics. And because of that, in rural schools that are very tight on number of teachers that they can employ, that is a value that they seek. With that, in regards in number of instructors in the state, as I mentioned, is about 240. Last year, there were 15 student teachers last spring. 11 of them took teaching positions. So we had about a 26% drop-off that did not take teaching positions. And a lot of that is because of the competition that I mentioned earlier. And so because of that, Mr. Chairman, we have tried as an association. I represent the Minnesota. I'm Jerry Schoenfeld, by the way. I don't think I mentioned that before.
I was going to ask you to mention your name for the record.
Yes, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I've done this 1,000 times. I should have gotten that right up front. But Jerry Schoenfeld, I represent the Minnesota Association of Agricultural Educators. And I can mention that the association itself is a very tight-knit group. And because of that, they've done a number of things over the years. They provide mentorship programs within the association, scholarships, recognitions for those who get teachers. As a matter of fact, that the common theme amongst ag teachers is that you cannot leave your position and retire until you find a replacement. And so there's recognition. We've had a lot of curriculum development. We have that have meet all the standards and benchmarks for science and economics and so forth, and a lot of professional development, and even been involved in hiring recruiters to help with this situation. But because of the fact that we've only got one institution in the state and a very limited number of students that are allowed into that institution, we have a real problem. And so our main area that we can go after here is try to keep retention of those people that we do graduate, and that's what this bill is about.
Wonderful. And Senator Jensen, before Senator Sparks moves the bill, council has a recommendation very similar to what we did with the last
Thank
bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members,
Mr.
it's the
Fuller.
Same sort of bookkeeping thing. So on page 2, line 2, after established, insert as a separate account in the special revenue fund in the state treasury. At page 2, line 4, after program, insert, and the money in the account is continuously appropriated to the commissioner for that purpose. And then on page 2, line 29, after education, insert or deposit in the agricultural education loan forgiveness program account.
Okay. Senator Sparks moves the oral amendment as stated by council. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Members, any additional questions for Senator Jensen? Seeing none, Senator Sparks moves that Senate File 1084 is recommended to pass as amended and referred to state and local government. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. With no further business, committee is adjourned.
But they were supposed to help.
We're all set.
All right. Moving stuff. Moving stuff. Yeah, I'll just do it for real quick.
Okay. Hey, how's it going?
I'll be right back to clean up.
Okay.
I'll help up.
Yeah.
Do it.
Thanks.
Julie, did we kill it that time? Next one, execution. We're learning.
All right, fellas.
Have a good
one.
Whatever.